Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The American College of Sports Medicine ranked the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington metropolitan area 41st out of 50 in its assessment of health and community fitness, which, for perspective, is better than New Orleans but worse than Detroit. So how does where you live relate to how you feel and how you take care of yourself? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Of course, average health and fitness assessments at the community-wide level don't necessarily predict how individual residents are doing, but shared resources like parks, streets, and trails, physical and mental health care providers, even neighborhood grocery stores add up to nudge us into either good habits or bad ones. Two guests today join us to talk about how we can set ourselves and our communities up for success. Dr. Eric Bing is professor of global health at SMU and senior fellow and director of global health at the George W. Bush Institute. John Seibert is president and chief operations officer of City Square. Both will participate in the Healthy City panel discussion at the Dallas Festival of Ideas, which takes place February 19th and 20th at Fair Park Music Hall. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Great to be here. Thank you.
What would you say is the difference between a healthy city and an unhealthy one?
Well, thanks, Chris. It's a great question. And I think that what we're really talking about is sort of healthy communities and unhealthy ones. Because really a city is made up of lots of communities. And even within cities, you can have healthy communities and unhealthy ones. And certainly it's going to be a confluence of whether people have opportunity, access to health care, access to food, being able to exercise, a place that's actually free of crime so they actually can interact and be a part of a community and become healthy.
And I would say in Dallas, part of the issue we face is we're a tale of two cities. So there's a part of Dallas that's very healthy and has access to healthy food, running trails, good health care. And then another part of Dallas that doesn't have access to any of it.
Let's talk about this word access, because people who do have access may sort of take it for granted that they can find their way to the things they need. What makes, we'll set the money aside for a minute, what makes access to healthcare harder if you don't live in a community, if for example, you don't drive or you don't have access to a car?
I think one of the things that strikes me in the work we do, especially in South Dallas, that I think people in other parts of the city don't think about is a simple issue like stray dogs. You can jog most parts of town and not have to worry about getting bitten by a dog. There are so many stray dogs in South Dallas, it's a joke to think about somebody going out for a run.
Because you just don't know what you're going to find down the street.
And so we don't think about good sidewalks, running trails, animal control, and then there are other issues like access to healthy food. We take for granted that there's going to be a grocery store on the corner or a place that we can go buy healthy food. That's not the reality for large swaths of this city. It's like a 16-mile radius where there's only one or two grocery stores in the southern sector. And so those families don't have access to a Tom Thumb or a Kroger right down the street.
What does it take to attract a full-service grocery store to lower-income neighborhoods?
My understanding is the business model is based on rooftops. So the notion would be that there's not enough density population-wise to justify the business model of those grocers, which then causes for some, leads us to question, okay, what kind of innovation can we have? Are there other models? And so there are experiments going on with a corner store initiative or other creative healthy food options, urban farming, for example, to try to create access in these areas that aren't probably going to fit the business model of large grocers.
And Chris, one of the things that many people think about access is a proximity issue, but it's certainly much more than just how close is it. It's do you feel comfortable going there? Do they speak the same language that you speak? Can you really afford to go there? So therefore, even though it may be you can go in and it could be available to you, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to use it or feel comfortable using it. I think that's really the issue that we have with healthcare, is that even though it, people may be able to get there on public transportation or drive, once they go there, they actually can't get care. And that's actually a major problem.
So what would make a facility, a healthcare provider, a place that somebody felt comfortable attending? You know, you mentioned language. What other signs can providers set out that either they're delighted to see patients who are lower income or maybe speak a different language, or that those patients are not really welcome?
Well, I think there's a number of things that, go with how comfortable a person will feel in a healthcare facility. You know, part of it might be, do they feel though it's a part of the community, that this is someplace that they're welcomed? Language is one of those, but is it affordable? Do I see people like me there? Are they respectful of the kinds of issues that I'm bringing there? And I think all those things can certainly go into whether a person is going to feel comfortable and want to go there.
The Affordable Care Act does not cover undocumented workers, which means in Texas that we have 1.68 million people who simply don't qualify to get insurance through the exchanges if they don't happen to have it through their jobs. What are the effects of that on public health in Texas?
I think there's major things that this is causing. You know, one of the things that we know is that when Texas didn't go with Medicaid expansion, you know, we're talking about a million people or more who haven't actually gotten health care, who fall below the poverty line but make too much to actually qualify. They are susceptible to lots of preventable diseases, diabetes, hypertension, things that you and I would just go for basic medical care. They won't be able to go. And it's really not until they get sick that they end up in the emergency room. And that costs us far more.
Are there ways to encourage providers, doctors to serve patients that maybe they just simply hadn't considered before, are not aware of?
Well, I think the motivator for hospitals is the cost-effective way of trying to get patients out of your emergency department. So I do think a lot of the work going on is motivated by a desire to lower the cost to the hospital systems. And so you'll see quite a few models that are focused on community clinics or other forms of care that funnel people out of the ED so that it costs less to care for those folks. Unfortunately, in Texas, we don't have very many physicians that take public insurance. So even some of our low-income neighbors that are insured can't find a physician. So we have a huge shortage of physicians that are actually willing to care for the poor in their practices. Ideally what would be great is to see doctors living in these communities again, and maybe a way to incentivize that. Or even there have been some great residency programs in Memphis and other parts of the country where residents enter into these low-income communities and folks grow up with a doctor down the street. And that then changes their notion of access. But the whole clinical environment can be very foreign to low-income communities if the hospital's not in my neighborhood, if these people don't look like me, if I've never grown up with the experience of going to a doctor. So there's some huge cultural disconnects. We see some promising ways to address that, but the current business model is really more about how do we lower the cost of care to physicians and hospital systems. And in the state of Texas, I think we're willing to say we'll focus on that instead of making sure that all of our neighbors have the right to health care.
Yeah. And just to follow up on that, you know, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. You know, I don't see this as a physician issue. I see this as a system issue, a policy issue, that until we can have a business model that works, providers are not going to be able to do that or will do that. There's numbers of other countries that have actually looked at different models by which you actually can provide care to people in communities.
What are the most important, if you had to make a list, Eric, a short list of preventive care and screening that everybody should receive, wealthy and not so wealthy, what would be included in that?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I mean, you can really even begin to sort of look at what's killing people. You know, cardiovascular disease is going to be one of the top killers of people. And that's going to be preventative things like exercise and monitoring of blood pressure and healthy eating. Diabetes is going to be associated with that, and they're going to be caused by many of those same exact determinants. And for children, it's going to be basic things like vaccinations that all children really need to have, and these very preventative things.
And, you know, in third world countries, we have this image of malnourishment as an emaciated child. In low-income communities in our city, the image is one of an obese child. They're malnourished because they don't have access to healthy food, and so there are chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension that are plaguing these communities. And so the face of malnourishment locally isn't as compelling to us, but it's still just as much a health crisis. That's where the social determinants come in. Everything he says is true as far as vaccinations and other types of screenings, but there's a lot of preventative health work that needs to be done because in these low-income communities, hypertension, diabetes, those kind of chronic diseases are rampant because of the social conditions.
Let's talk about that, because in the United States in general and in Texas in particular, we love this phrase, personal responsibility. And I think it's one that all of us, you know, take some pride in when we think about taking care of our health. Why is it harder to exercise personal responsibility if you happen to be living in poverty?
Well, I think there are so many factors. Kids don't get to choose where they live. They don't get to choose whether the house they're in is standard or substandard. But you have a number of substandard houses in low-income communities that people of affluence would never raise their kids in by choice. Those factors affect children's health and diseases like asthma in a huge way. Safety. We value safety, but we don't often think about that safety is a direct correlation to health. If kids are in communities that aren't safe to be outside and playing, it's not safe to go down the street or go to the park. That has an effect. If there's not a park in your community, if there aren't sports leagues, what does that do to the health of a child? If there's not produce at the local grocery store, if you can't go down the sidewalk without getting chewed up by a dog, we don't even think about some of those factors. They're just kind of baked in culturally to affluent neighborhoods. We just assume that's going to be a part of it. When you don't have those conditions, all of those factors become barriers to health.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you can sort of even look at these things that these are environmental nudges,
right?
Nudges moving you towards, you know, better health. You have you're employed, so therefore you have insurance. They will remind you when these screens are done. They will remind you that you need to get your glasses. You have things going on in a workplace. If you're in a community where you have these organized neighborhoods or that is safe, there are things that you're just not going to experience. And you could say, well, you know, I'm being personally responsible. Well, you're in an
environment with a lot of help.
With a whole lot of help that you never see.
Mm-hmm.
You see it when you don't have it. And that's actually what we see in many poor communities. They don't have it, and then we begin to see all of the sequelae of this. And then we can say, well, you're not being personally responsible. Well, but nobody really is. It's really the environment that's creating a safety net for many, many people. And you begin to see what happens when the safety net falls apart in many of these poor communities.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Eric Bing, who is Senior Fellow and Director of Global Health at the George W. Bush Institute, and John Seibert, President and Chief Operations Officer at City Square. They will both be panelists at the Dallas Festival of Ideas, February 19th and 20th, talking about the healthy city. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about creating a healthy city with John Seibert, who is President and Chief Operations Officer of City Square, and Dr. Eric Bing, Professor of Global Health at SMU. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can see my guests participating in panel discussions at the Dallas Festival of Ideas February 19th and 20th at Fair Park. Should we choose zip codes where people are having the most trouble staying healthy and focus our efforts there?
I definitely think hot spotting makes a lot of sense as far as getting the most bang for the buck in an intervention and lowering cost to the community, but also maximizing impact. I think there's a lot to that strategy that's worth exploring.
Yeah, and going back to John's comment earlier is that, you know, there are two Dallases, and we need to look at where the need is greatest and put our efforts there. That's not to say that we should ignore the other areas, but we know that there are some structural structures there that will help support the community, and some of these areas have much greater need.
Mm-hmm. How important is public policy in all of this? You know, it's come up a couple times, John, something as simple as, you know, making sure there are no stray dogs running around and that the sidewalks are okay. That seems like a relatively easy fix.
You would think. I do think policy is very important as far as how municipalities allocate resources and what kind of choices we make as far as what kind of community we want. But too often I think the choice is about preserving individual liberty at the expense of the community and not thinking in terms of we're all in this together. What choices can we make that will allow us to share prosperity and have the best experience for the whole community?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Eric, I know that you've been very interested in solutions in the developing world, technologies that can be put to use in novel ways. Are there things we might do now that most people have access to mobile phone technology, often smartphone technology, that could help people take better care of themselves?
Absolutely. One of the things that I focus on is innovative and entrepreneurial ways that people are able to maintain or protect health in developing countries. And there's many of those things that we can use right here. And you're quite right. Most people have access to cell phones, and many of them will have smartphones. And those things can actually be used to monitor blood pressure, to create nudges for people. One of the things that we've also seen in developing countries as well as here is the increased use of telemedicine or video conferencing to get healthcare. So therefore, you can have in Dallas, our doctors are maldistributed. They're in sort of the north part of the city as well as along sort of a corridor. But in South Dallas and West Dallas, we really don't have healthcare. In areas like that, you actually can use providers by video conferencing or telemedicine to actually interact with patients as long as you have like a nurse nearby to actually explain these things.
John, have you traveled to other cities that you think are doing a better job than we're being rather Dallas-centric today because it's the conversation is going to take place as part of the Dallas Festival of Ideas, but all of North Texas maybe could learn something from other parts of the country that have tried to address health and poverty.
I haven't personally traveled to very many of those cities. It's more been anecdotal that mm-hmm. I've heard of. Different cities, some of it depends on the culture of the city. If, you know, warm climate cities, a San Diego, for example, or a Denver, it's not a warm climate city, but it's an outdoorsy community. Those kind of areas that value the outdoors and recreation tend to do a really good job. So we've seen some really fascinating work in Colorado where there's kind of a state coalition that works on health issues. Dallas is actually has launched a Children's Health and Wellness Alliance. Based on something they saw in Wisconsin, and Children's Health really helped spearhead that, but is bringing stakeholders together from all sectors in Dallas to focus on multiple children's health issues. So they started with asthma, and now they've also moved to obesity. But it's a way of kind of collectively, if we pull our resources and all the stakeholders together, maybe we can create kind of a movement around health for children. So that's a best practice model that we're trying to adopt here in Dallas.
Yeah, and one of the things that I, you know, John raises is that Most of the successful ones are going to be either policy related, it's like the Affordable Care Act, getting people basic health care, or community mobilization where you're pulling all the stakeholders together. I think that one of the things we will often look at is communities with problems. Well, wherever there's a problem, there's also a solution. And the solution is also probably going to be right there in the community. And by pulling together people in the community, various stakeholders, you can be successful. So, for example, in High Point, North Carolina, they had a major drug problem. It was really only when they began to pull all the stakeholders together, the police, the community, the housing officials, and began to have them work together, were they able to be successful at lowering their substance abuse rates quite significantly. And other communities have also been successful at these community impact models that pull everyone together.
We haven't talked yet about access to mental health care, which, of course, falls under the umbrella of health care, but a lot of people think of them in different ways. Is this harder for people in low-income communities, John?
Very much so. It's hard in this state, period. You know, currently our criminal justice system is the primary mental health care provider. So, you know, if you want mental health care in Dallas, you probably need to go to the county jail.
The sheriff will say that herself.
Oh, yes. So we've got to do a better job of that. I do think there's some awareness from the community that we have to invest more in mental health issues. There's also an awareness of, example, in the fight against poverty, that poverty is a traumatic experience. So people in poverty have been traumatized in various ways. And so a lot of the ways they behave and act out are informed by the trauma they experienced. So they're realizing there's a huge behavioral health connection. Similar to like a vet coming back from Iraq, there's some PTSD from poverty, and that children are traumatized. In fact, their brains don't even fully grow if they're in poverty too long, too soon. So that's leading to a connection to, poor people tend to be depressed because they're in a traumatic situation over a long period of time. So I think there's an awakening that may lead to some new solutions as far as how do we get more proactive about mental health care? Because some people think your mental illness causes poverty. What we're finding out is that poverty has a way of causing mental illness.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. One of the things that complicates it with mental health care is that people don't there's a lot of shame and stigma around being depressed or being anxious or having a substance abuse problem. Although I think if you look at most people, my family included, you see people with those types of challenges. I mean, I have my immediate family, people with mental health problems, and people don't want to talk about it. We certainly didn't want to talk about it, and we had access to health care.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't have access to health care, it's much, much worse because you can't get treated.
And are there providers available who would be willing to do this treatment? Do we have enough professionals going into mental health fields that if we could, distribute patients to providers, we could take care of everybody?
One of the things that's happening in mental health care is that a lot of the mental health care is actually going to primary care providers, mm-hmm. or pediatricians. And often the treatment they will prescribe will be medications. Well, medications aren't always needed, and often it is community, it is support, it is behavioral types of interventions that can help keep people healthy and sane. One of the things that we certainly see in substance abuse is that you have many people who will start out as a frequent users, but then it begins to be an addiction. And if we can stop them early through community-based interventions, we'll be much better.
I think we definitely need more investment and funding for additional providers. But there's also an awareness that there are social determinants of mental health too. So, for example, in the issue with homelessness and the number of unhoused neighbors that we have in Dallas, there's an awakening to the fact that housing would be a great way to improve the mental health of folks that are currently unhoused. And too often we think, well, if we treat the substance abuse first, or if we get them on meds and treat the mental illness first, then they should qualify for housing. The truth is substance abuse and mental illness will stabilize much more often if people are housed first. And so I think some of the issues in the news currently about homelessness, we need to look long and hard about how much we're willing to invest in permanent supportive housing, because that in and of itself would be a wonderful mental health initiative.
What do you do with the argument that I know that you've heard from people, which is that, well, I work for a living and I'm paying for my own expenses. Why should this individual have housing provided?
The county jail has a list of frequent flyers of over 250 people that are unhoused, chronically homeless, some mentally ill, many substance abusers. Each one costs the county $40,000 a year to be on the streets and trips to Parkland, to the jail, to the mental hospital. We're doing a housing development right now that'll house each one of 50 of those folks for $15,000 a year per person. So how about we house them and save taxpayers some money? We think it's the smart way to do the right thing. And would you rather them be drunk in their apartment or on your business stoop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, and just as we look at ourselves and realize that prevention is going to be much cheaper than cure, the same is true with what's going on in our community, is preventing these problems by providing care, providing services, and a safety net. We will be able to avoid problems down the road. And I think one of the things that these recent problems that we've had right here in Dallas with like Ebola and with Zika shows us that the problems that happen elsewhere end up at our doorstep if we aren't thoughtful and protective and prevent these issues elsewhere.
There's already so much on the plate of the public education system, but it's occurred to me that neighborhood schools might be a great place to provide services or at least tell people where to find them, because they're really at the heart of every residential community in the city. Is there a reason why schools aren't more often considered as places where people might get connected with services that they could use, whether or not they have kids in those schools?
Well, one of the things that I think that we end up with is sort of a siloing of services, that we'll have an education system, a healthcare delivery system. And I think increasingly we are going to be moving to an integration of these various systems, because the people who have problems with healthcare also have problems with education, also have issues of poverty. And if we can co-locate these services, it will actually help everyone. Similar to going to a grocery store and picking up your pharmaceuticals, you're much more likely to do it. And I think we need to look at ways of making this easy for communities as opposed to more complicated.
Yeah, I think schools are a great resource, and we're seeing some promising programs there. North Dallas High School has a homeless, you know, kind of a day center for homeless students. The Health and Wellness Alliance for Children here in Dallas, as it researched asthma, the assumption was that children admitted at Children's Hospital and brought into the ER would spike over the weekend when the kids were home with mom and dad. And what they found out is it actually spiked on Mondays, because they got back to school and it was the school nurses that said, this kid's not breathing well, this kid needs treatment. And they were the first line of defense in dealing with asthma. And so that led to some ahas around, okay, how can we collaborate with school nurses to really at scale help children's asthma in Dallas? And so I think those kind of connections to schools and churches and other centers of community in these low-income neighborhoods is really important.
Yeah. And I would say certainly not just low-income neighborhoods, but really every neighborhood.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Is, you know, make it easy for people to get what they need.
I want to talk about dental care, which to some people might sound like a luxury, but, you know, I'll never forget an interview that I did with a woman who talked about, you know, bad teeth keep you from getting a job, because you don't, you know, if you're missing teeth, somehow you might be qualified to do some work, but people are going to pass you up. How easy is it to access dental care in this part of the country if you are low income?
Dental care is not an area that I know a lot about, but certainly what I know in other parts of the United States, certainly Los Angeles, where I used to live and work, it's a major problem for people who actually don't have access to health insurance. And even when people do, if it's not sort of readily accessible, people won't use it. And so it causes major problems for the community. And I said, you're certainly right. If your mouth doesn't look like it, it's very hard to get a job.
And there's a vast shortage of dental care. Some of it's based on what it takes to run a dental practice. Mm-hmm. It's much more difficult to open a dental practice as a charity clinic, for example. The overhead on all the equipment and the chairs and that kind of stuff. So you see a number of nonprofits and other community, you know, based organizations, they find it easier to bring in a primary care doc than to get dental going. But there are some groups working on some solutions to try to bring more dental care to neighborhoods that don't have access to it currently.
And one of the things that some have actually done is creating dental vans, because they are expensive to set up. And so by bringing the equipment and the providers into the community, they can then be moved to another community in order to spread this rare resource around.
I don't know how often either of you in the work that you do meet people who say, I'm qualified, I'm able to help, but I don't quite know how to find people in need. Maybe not so often.
Well, I think often it's not finding the people in need. It's actually finding the organizations,
right,
or the
okay.
services that they can then plug themselves into.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually what I think what's important is that they find an organization that's already doing this, so they actually can use their expertise to actually help.
Yeah, and I think there's maybe just an intuitive notion that short-term or episodic help isn't going to really make that much of a difference, that the biggest help to these communities is empowering these communities with opportunity. So, for example, in access to healthcare, yes, we need some physicians and nurse practitioners and people like that that folks can go to, but we probably need a whole lot of community health workers that live in those communities that are trained, that people know every day. And we've seen some really exciting developments happen when the neighbors in these communities are actually included in the solution and allowed to be a part of the service delivery. And I think some people that volunteer kind of realize that after a while, that I can do this every once in a while, but what's really needed is probably a change in the model.
We're speaking this hour with John Seibert, who is professor and chief operations officer of City Square, and Dr. Eric Bing, professor of global health at SMU. Both will take place in the Dallas Festival of Ideas over the weekend. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with two panelists who will speak about the healthy city this weekend at the Dallas Festival of Ideas. Dr. Eric Bing is professor of global health at SMU, and John Seibert is president and chief operations officer of City Square. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Sean in Fort Worth. Hi, Sean.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Oh, I love the show, and I'm really happy you guys highlighted the mental health problems, especially associated with drugs. I was wondering, I can't remember who it was exactly. I saw it floating around Facebook a bit. There was a Texas politician who came out and said that mental health problems don't exist. I believe that's probably one of the – I see this happen all the time, and my mom suffers from bipolar disorder. So I see this this kind of, I don't know if it's a lobbyist effort or what it may be, but there seems to be some kind of, not even a stigma, but an outright kind of battle against the existence of mental health care and the mental disability in the first place. I wonder if you guys could talk about that.
Thanks for your call.
Sean, thanks so much for raising that. You know, I totally agree. I think there's this there's certainly a lot of shame and denial around mental health care, and one of the things that doesn't help is when we have people in political positions or people of influence who will continue that. But certainly as communities speak out and those of us whose families have been affected by this speak out, we can begin to rid ourselves of denial.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Aileen who says, you haven't touched on the role insurance companies play in preventing doctors and dentists from providing care for everyone. Many healthcare providers simply can't take some insurance because they lose money when they do. My son does a lot of work for patients who can't afford dental work, but he has to be able to pay his employees and his expenses. And I think this is a concern sometimes with on the healthcare side with coverage from Medicaid. A lot of doctors will say they simply can't afford to provide care to these patients.
Yeah, you know, and what I've experienced or seen from the Affordable Care Act so far is it has seemed to increase access to health care. It has sparked some innovation, but there were some aspects of it that tried to kind of, I guess, accommodate insurance companies. And I think a number of the pinch points on the current form of the Affordable Care Act have to do with the role insurance companies still play in healthcare. And I do think that's probably an issue that needs to be addressed.
You think cities would be healthier if we had single-payer insurance? Not that that's on the table seriously at this point.
I think if we can get above political ideology and really focus on solutions that might work, I think it has to be on the table and be considered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about ways to keep people from starting a substance abuse habit. We know how hard it is once people really have a habit or an addiction to changing those behaviors. What can we do? Does anything work demonstrably to keep people from picking up a substance problem in the first place?
Well, I think one of the things that we talked about earlier is having communities that are supportive of people who begin to have stress or beginning to have problems. So therefore, they actually can deal with any of the kind of problems they have with the without resorting to the medication that's most readily available, and that's going to be drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. But then when they do, I think there are a number of behavioral interventions. Even just talking to a provider and something called motivational interviewing can really sort of help us decrease rates of people advancing from low and moderate drug use and alcohol use to heavy use. Very, very simple things. One of the things that, you know, I work at SMU, and SMU recently has begun a partnership with the city in order to take help the city work with academics who often will think differently. And the city initiative, one of the projects that we're working on is in global health with our students. Working with the police department around this K2 epidemic that is happening in the city, because I think we need to look at sort of innovative ways that we can begin to sort of rid people who have these problems.
K2 is the artificial marijuana, is that?
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. K2 is a synthetic type of marijuana, and so it's a lot of it's coming in from China. Sort of pharmaceuticals that they create in different proportions. It works because it's really, really cheap, it's fast acting, and it can't be picked up with regular drug screens. It's cheaper than food. So if you are homeless or you have other kinds of problems, you want to get a quick high. And so we've had more than 200 people in the past 2 months end up in the emergency rooms, often floridly psychotic, with this K2 problem. And the police department is really beginning to sort of lead the fight and to try to rid this. And we have some SMU students who are helping them create the kind of strategies that may be effective.
I think on the issue of substance abuse, we're going to have to look at the underlying causes of trauma and look at ways to minimize traumatic experiences as well, because there are a number of functional people that medicate. Mm-hmm. And so some of this is incremental, that there are people medicating just enough to still function, keep their jobs, be considered good members of society, and then there are others that have taken it further than that. Some of the changes may be incremental, and there's some research that says, you know, a job is a great way to stop substance abuse.
Because you got to get up the next morning.
A motivation, mm-hmm. hope, a different future. So I think addressing issues of hope and opportunity, issues of trauma, Those are probably the causes. Substance abuse is probably the effect.
I would definitely agree with that. And I think we also have to recognize that there are going to be people with a biological predisposition to many of these disorders and to substance abuse. While I would definitely agree, the environment is going to play a huge role of whether you may get it or not. You may be biologically predisposed to some of these conditions, and we just can't forget that.
Definitely.
Would we be a healthier city if we focused on drug use as a medical problem, medical issue, rather than a criminal justice problem or issue?
Absolutely. I think, if you sort of, look at some of the models that have begun to look at substance abuse as a health problem, with the police department asking people with substance abuse problems to come in and turn in their drugs and there won't be charged with crimes has actually been effective in getting people into healthcare.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Randy in Fort Worth. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on. I had a question for your guest. My son was a meth user. He's been 4 months sober now, but he had to spend 2 weeks in the Terrell State Hospital after two other weeks of hospitalization in the DFW area. And he's a type 1 diabetic. When the local hospital was trying to get him in the Terrell State Hospital, they didn't really want to take him because he was a type 1 diabetic. They were concerned with the liability for that, but they're a hospital. And then they finally took him. But I understand that the state hospitals have really, really ratcheted back on the number of available rooms for people with severe mental illness. And I wanted to ask your guest if you knew anything about the capacity of the state mental hospitals in the state of Texas and what capacity, the max capacity they have, and what capacity is being used.
Great. Want to congratulate your son on his sobriety and also to thank you for being so supportive of him. Family support is going to be critical in helping people remain clean and sober. I think the issue of access to hospital beds, it's an important one. It's not an area that I've been focused on and I know a lot about, and I'm wondering if John may know a little bit more about some of the issues of access to mental health.
I don't have the actual data. Mine would be anecdotal, but I have heard similar stories that suggest that there may have been some policy changes that are limiting access, or there may be a lack of resources, that there may be some financial pressures that we possibly have starved some of those resources. But I know just enough to be dangerous.
I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, John, which is that there's great success with some programs when you go into communities and you really make the people who will be served, treat them as stakeholders and also treat them as people who might, have a clue to the solution. What kinds of surprising things do you discover, does anyone discover, when they, speak directly with the individuals who might benefit from some help?
We had an experience years ago at City Square in training a woman from the community to manage her diabetes. And she became so good at it, she was mentoring all of her neighbors. And then she was invited to present a medical paper at Cornell Medical School. Wow. On her approach to diabetes education. We've had Spanish-speaking neighbors in our clinic produce a telenovela that they could show in their community that educated people on how to take care of themselves when they have diabetes. And so the creativity, the capacity in our neighbors to be a part of the solution, I think is really encouraging.
In terms of communities where people are, we've talked about diet. We've talked a little bit about exercise. Lots of people who are working multiple jobs and may just be exhausted, may not be sleeping well at night. Like exercise might seem like the last thing on their minds. Are there ways to help people kind of recognize the value of staying active and the importance of that in a lot of different aspects of health?
Well, I think one of the things we're seeing in some of the new urbanist movement maybe in Dallas is this notion that this city was built for cars and not for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think there are some structural things like that, that you got a lot of working folks that are stuck on a commute or stuck on a DART train trying to get to where the jobs are, and where the affordable housing is isn't where the job is. And so there are pressures like that that I hesitate to tell those people, no, you just really need to make time to exercise. I know there's truth to that, but I think what we're also seeing is the pressures, economic pressures and structural social determinants that are working adversely against people's health.
I think also as we begin to make our city more walkable, so people actually could walk to the grocery store, walk to wherever they need to go, to the pharmacy, it'll make getting exercise a part of a routine. It's hard here in Dallas, which actually gets quite hot for much of the year. But I think that as parts of the community begin to concentrate, that will actually be helpful, and that makes no difference on whether it's a wealthy area or a poor area. Making things that are close to people and having it safe is really critical for health.
When you look at the overall health of the city and of the culture of the city, there may be people who say, I'm doing fine. It doesn't really matter to me what's happening to other people. There is still an appeal, right, to businesses that want to come in. They look at sort of the amenities that are available in a city and the overall health climate of a city.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the real estate values in Uptown, mm-hmm. where there's the Katy Trail and bumps up to Clyde Warren Park. And, yeah, those kind of amenities matter a lot, not just to employers, but to their emerging workforce. I think millennials want a walkable city. They want to play where they live, and those are really important factors.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a good health is smart business for a city.
Mm-hmm. Do you all feel optimistic, pessimistic about what we're looking at over the next few years?
I'm personally optimistic. I think we're waking up to how the we can collectively across sectors come together to find solutions. So I think there are some really important ahas. I saw that yesterday in the city council meeting where you have DISD and the Dallas City Council talking about how housing policy can have an impact on the diversity of the school system. I think those kind of conversations and this notion that we're all in it together, I'm encouraged by folks from the northern part of town finally being committed to growing all of Dallas. And so I think we have a real opportunity here to make an impact.
John Seibert is President and Chief Operations Officer for City Square. Dr. Eric Bing is Professor of Global Health at SMU. Both will participate in the Healthy City panel discussion at the Dallas Festival of Ideas, which takes place February 19th and 20th at Fair Park Music Hall. Gentlemen, it's been great to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.